Hello and welcome to this special CertSecurity.com Data Protection School podcast, sponsored by Reconnex. I'm Billy Hurley, and it's great to have you with us. In this podcast, we're going to engage in some fact or fiction, focusing on how to define a trade secret and how an organization's most confidential information should be protected. Joining me today is Russell Jones. Russell has significant experience working with Deloitte & Touche clients in the development and implementation of information security, privacy, and data protection programs. He has more than 15 years in consulting and has worked with a number of Fortune 500 corporations, including several in the Fortune 100. Thanks for being here with us, Russell.
Hey, thanks a lot, Billy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Russell, to set the stage, we're going to be talking about some common misconceptions that security folks may have about trade secrets and how to properly protect them. So let's go over how this works. I'll read a statement, and you'll tell me if that statement is fact or if it's fiction, and then explain why. So let's get started with the first one. Fact or fiction? An example of a patent would be a life sciences organization's documentation of the entire manufacturing process for a drug, which they have carefully protected.
That would be fiction. Actually, what you just described is a great example of a trade secret. And essentially, with trade secrets, I mean, if you look at something like the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, trade secrets are defined to include things like formulas, patterns, methods, techniques, processes, you know, even things like supplier data, flowcharts, et cetera. So, you know, typically when you look at something like a manufacturing process, you know, you don't typically go and get a patent for that, right? Because the manufacturing process will include everything about how to manufacture something. In this example, you just talked about a drug. So it would be things like the recipe card, you know, what are all the specific mixtures of specific different, you know, ingredients that make that drug, and then what are the environmentals like for the manufacturing facility, and then what are all the configurations and settings for the machines, and so on and so forth. All of that together gets documented into a manufacturing process, right? That thing, that manufacturing process, is an example of a trade secret, because an organization really wouldn't want their competitor to understand how to do that thing, right? How do they actually make the drug? I mean, it'd be very difficult, for example, to take the drug on the market, let's say, and try to reverse engineer how to actually come up with that drug that has that particular, you know, medicinal properties, right? And so that's really a great example of a trade secret.
Okay, then, fact or fiction, a trade secret represents a set of exclusive rights granted by the government.
That would be fiction, actually. A patent actually represents a set of exclusive rights granted by the government in order to get legal protections for an invention. So, I mean, first thing is, patents are really about inventions versus a trade secret. It's an organization's internal knowledge, right? It's something internal to an organization that they believe is secret, and they go through great lengths to maintain secret. And by virtue of keeping that, you know, thing secret, like the manufacturing process, for example, it gives them a competitive advantage, right? The trade secret is really just internal information, internal knowledge that a company claims it alone knows, and which is a very valuable internal asset, versus a patent, you know, really is, it represents a set of exclusive rights that's granted by the government in exchange for the public disclosure of that invention. So, you know, you have to kind of disclose that invention to the world, but in return, you get, you know, protection for a certain amount of time from the government where people can't go out and take your invention and go and replicate it, build it, and sell it for profit.
Fact or fiction, Russ. In general, to prove in court that you possess a trade secret, you must convince the court on three distinct points.
That would be a fact. When you have a trade secret, and actually to even demonstrate or prove a trade secret's validity, you'd have to go to court and do a litigation process to be able to prove it. So, again, contrasting with patents, you know, a patent, you go through a very rigorous, you know, formal process to actually gain the patent, you know, get the documentation from the U.S. Patent Office that, you know, basically grants you those exclusive rights that we talked about. And it's a very formal and rigorous process. But once you go through it, you've got that, you know, piece of paper that proves that you're the owner of that patent, and also the rights that you are, you know, essentially have obtained by going through that process. Whereas with the trade secret, you know, you have to really kind of go through and essentially protect the secrecy of that trade secret, which would be point number one. So, you know, you really have to restrict the knowledge of that trade secret, again, going back to the manufacturing process, to a very small group of people that have a need to know, that have some reason to understand that manufacturing process. That would be point number one, secrecy. And because of that secrecy, you would then be able to demonstrate that there was independent economic value, right? So that's the part of the second test. And then the third test is security. Did you put reasonable controls in place to protect that secret? If you get into a situation where you believe you've had a trade secret that was stolen from you, and now you're taking somebody to court through litigation, you're going to have to demonstrate to the court that you know, essentially, that secret was in fact secret. It wasn't published out on the internet, and it wasn't talked about by everybody in the company, but actually only a very few people knew about it. And it did, as a result, cause you to have independent economic value, which is really your competitive advantage. And then the third test, where most organizations fall down, Billy, is the fact that they didn't have reasonable controls in place to protect that secret. You would be looking for things like procedures and controls in place to restrict, you know, digital forms of that trade secret, you know, were there access controls in place, those type of things to really restrict who could get access to that trade secret. Again, I go back to the manufacturing process because it's a great example. Were there things in place that you would expect to see, like, you know, education and awareness, access controls? That would really be what you would have to demonstrate if you wanted to, you know, claim that it was a trade secret.
Is it a challenge to prove that security measures are reasonable? Because what I consider to be reasonable protection may differ from other people.
You know, the answer is that's why we have standards. That's why many organizations today are adopting standards like ISO 17799 2005, because it's the only way to be able to, demonstrate that you took an approach that was considered reasonable, that was well understood in the community, among security practitioners, among internal and external auditors, among risk professionals. And that's the way a lot of organizations are going. They're adopting standards like that, which really do give leading industry practices for, you know, access control, for, you know, auditing, and what does that look like, for how you organize your security organization, how do you do asset management. So those type of standards are what people are essentially adopting and implementing, so that when you do get into discussions, whether it's with the auditors or anywhere else, about, you know, was this reasonable or not, it's pretty defensible when you can point to a standard that's internationally known and accepted.
We're halfway there, Russell. Here's the next statement. Fact or fiction, the most difficult aspect of protecting trade secrets is knowing what a trade secret is and where those trade secrets exist within an organization.
Yeah, that would actually definitely be a fact. That is really the big problem. A lot of organizations I work with, you know, when we sit down and kind of, you know, try to help them get a handle on, you know, the trade secret issue, you know, one of the first problems is really just saying, well, what are all the trade secrets? You know, do you even know all the things that in your organization you would declare as a trade secret? It's so varied in terms of what could be considered a trade secret, that becomes part of the problem. So, yeah, the first thing is assuming that you have an inventory of all your trade secrets. You've gone through the process of sitting down with the business process owners, the data owners, the people that really know, you know, whether, you know, information, certain types of information is in fact specific to the organization and provides competitive advantage, and you wouldn't want your, you know, competitors or the public to know how you do this particular thing. Assuming you know that, the other part of the equation is knowing where in the organization and in what form the trade secrets exist. And by that I mean, you know, is the trade secret something that's like in a lab notebook, a physical notebook, or is it on a piece of paper, or is it actually electronic in a database or in a file share somewhere, or, you know, in an application system? So, you know, that really becomes the challenge to then start looking at the organization and understanding from a business process data flow perspective, you know, where these trade secrets exist and who's handling them, And then does that map back to who should be touching and handling those trade secrets based on, you know, what the trade secret is about? And does that jive with someone's job responsibilities and in particular, you know, projects or initiatives that are going on? Those are real challenges, Billy.
Russell, fact or fiction, a non-disclosure agreement is the most effective measure for preventing trade secret theft.
That would be fiction. And there's probably some confusion around this. You know, a non-disclosure agreement, a confidentiality agreement, it's great thing as part of your controls you should have in place, particularly when trade secrets and knowledge of trade secrets is being disclosed and shared with third parties, for example, business partners, for example. However, is it the most effective measure for preventing, you know, the operative word being prevent trade secret? Absolutely not. People that are going to want to steal your trade secrets are really the types of people that don't care about, you know, our laws and certainly don't care about the contractual implications of breaching the non-disclosure agreement. So, you know, if you're talking about legally protecting yourself, contractually protecting yourself, then, yeah, NDA's confidentiality agreements are great. If you're talking about preventing the theft in the first place, you know, this is not an effective measure. Effective measures actually would be things like access controls, for example. Let's say the trade secret is contained in a database, and the database is not replicated anywhere else in your organization. You know, putting access controls in place to restrict only people that have been given the appropriate access to access that particular part of the database that has the trade secret would be an example of a preventive measure for, you know, preventing a trade secret from getting out the door. But again, it's not as black and white as that, Billy. It's really much more complex because you can have people that have been given authorization to access the trade secret, and then now they've got it, and now the question is, what will they do with it? You know, it could be as simple as they didn't handle it properly. They printed out a piece of paper, left it on the printer, threw it in the trash can, and now that trade secret's out the door. And once a trade secret gets out the organization and it gets discovered, you know, either intentionally, accidentally by people that you didn't want to know it was a secret, it loses its status immediately. So it's not a trade secret anymore.
Okay, Russell, here's the last one. Fact or fiction. One of the most effective protective measures for preventing the theft of trade secrets is intrusion prevention systems.
I would say that's fiction, and here's why. So an intrusion prevention system, which is an extension of an intrusion detection system, is really all about, its real mission is to prevent an intrusion, to prevent an outsider from gaining access to a system and data that they're, you know, not supposed to be able to get. Contrast that with trade secrets. At any point in this life cycle, because, you know, it's, trade secret is just information, and information has a life cycle, right? It's created, it's used, it's shared, it's archived, it's destroyed at some point. So at any point in the life cycle of a particular trade secret, it could exist in the form of physical paper. And really what you're concerned about with trade secrets, you know, you'd be equally concerned with people trying to obtain access to a trade secret. You'd also be concerned about trade secrets leaking out of the organization, either intentionally or it's just accidental. You know, people, sometimes things get published to external-facing websites that shouldn't be on that website. Or now that that's published, let's say your trade secret's been reduced to a PDF file, it accidentally got uploaded to your, you know, external-facing website, and it's just out there. No one knows. As soon as somebody goes to that website and finds that thing, you know, again, the trade secret status is lost. And I submit an intrusion prevention system is not going to help you with those scenarios. But we can talk about what are some of the effective measures. You know, one of the most effective measures for preventing, and again, I keep saying preventing versus, you know, detecting after the fact that you've had trade secret theft. That's not going to really help you at that point. But one non-technological measure, which people don't like to hear, but when I talk to a lot of my clients, and you get the most bang for your buck from education and awareness, Billy, because if you think about, you know, this is really a people problem, right? Mm-hmm. And the people in your organization, whether they're employees, whether they're contractors, whatever, if they don't, one, understand that the information that they're handling is a trade secret, you've already got a problem. And then secondly, if they don't understand, okay, let's assume they understand what they're handling is a trade secret, if they haven't given the proper kind of education awareness on the types of controls, and protective measures they should be employing daily and how they handle that thing, you know, then the trade secret's still going to get out there. You know, we talk about technological solutions, assuming the trade secret's in some kind of a digital format, there are some very interesting emerging solutions out there that essentially can prevent access to the trade secret and can also send alerts and monitors to people that have been designated that, you know, someone is trying to, you know, take this trade secret that's not authorized. They're trying to print it, for example. They're trying to forward it via email, for example. You know, so we're talking about products like Veracept and Tablas, which actually is now owned by EMC. Those kind of products and products from Adobe are emerging, which really are data-centric security kind of products. They actually, the access control is put close to the data and follows the data wherever it goes. And if you think about it, it makes sense because the data is going through the life cycle. It's being used. It's being shared. It's being, you know, viewed on a computer. It, and, you know, it's going across the network. It's, now it's in a database. Now it's being archived. So, you know, there's a whole new kind of emerging field and school of thought and products around data-centric security where your access control and protective measures follow the data as opposed to the, you know, the previous models where you had, you know, access control points, you know, at your perimeter or your host systems that would enforce access control rules at that particular point against the particular type of data. That was a long-winded answer, but hopefully that answered the question there.
No, Russell, great job. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Billy. I appreciate it. It was very much my pleasure.
For more materials in our Data Protection School, visit searchsecurity.com/data protection. You can also listen to more of our podcasts on our podcast page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. Special thanks once again to Russell Jones of Deloitte & Touche, and special thanks to our sponsor, Reconnex. Thanks for joining us. I'm Billy Hurley. Have a great day.